Hello everyone and welcome once again to Motos and Friends. This is the weekly podcast brought to you by the editors at Ultimate Motorcycling Magazine. My name is Arthur Coldwells. This week, editors Don Williams and Nick DeSena discuss the new Moto Guzzi Stelvio. It has been around 8 years since Moto Guzzi updated the Stelvio, and so expectations were quite high when Nick went to the launch recently in Spain. Don chats with Nick about his experience with the new bike and whether this new version is now a credible ADV bike. Motos and Friends is brought to you by Arai Helmets. Yes, there is such a thing as the Arai difference, and it reflects the company's incredible attention to detail. For instance, if your experience has been that helmets are hard to get on, then you need to try the Arai Contour X, designed with a wider bottom opening for easier on and off. It is the helmet you've been waiting for. Once on, you'll be amazed at the extreme comfort of the Contour X. That's a key benefit for long distance touring. Another example of the Arai difference, side air channels. The Corsair X utilizes internal ducting, and that effectively increases the extraction of hot, moist air from the eyeport area. And that helps reduce shield fogging and increase your comfort. You need to get to your local Arai dealer and try the Contour X and the Corsair X. You won't be disappointed. Or if you want to learn more, visit ArayAmericas.com. In the second segment this week, Associate Editor TJ Adams chats with Ray Hammonds. Despite his mature age, a couple years ago, Ray realized a long-time dream: to learn how to ride a motorcycle. To say that he jumped in with both feet is somewhat of an understatement. Ray was fortunate enough to attend the YCRS Champ School when he first got his license, and interestingly, he credits the school with saving his life almost immediately. The topic of whether you should cover the brake when riding is actually quite controversial, and if you do it during an MSF course, you will fail. This is patently wrong. And Ray is clearly hoping the right people wake up and this change is made to rider training across the country. We'll see. So, from all of us here at Ultimate Motorcycling, we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, this is Don Williams, editor of Ultimate Motorcycling, and I'm here with senior editor Nick DeSena, and we're going to talk about the 2024 Moto Guzzi Stelvio. It's a all-new version of the Stelvio, nothing like the old one, and Nick flew over the Atlantic Ocean just to ride it. What happened there?
It's true. We did traverse the Atlantic Ocean, doing our normal thing of hanging out in steerage seats and all that good stuff, you know, the illustrious life of a moto journalist. But at any rate, the Stelvio has been a namesake that has been missing from Moto Guzzi's lineup for a few years now. It's, you know, depending on the market you're in, it really disappeared from the lineup around the 2016 model year. It may have stuck around, give or take a year, depending on where you call home. But for all intents and purposes, it's been about 10 years since the Stelvio has really been in the US lineup. And if we think about the Stelvio as a model, it leaned into that emerging, at least at the time, adventure touring aesthetic. So it wasn't quite, you know, your most aggressive adventure bike on the platform, on, you know, in the grand scheme of things. It didn't have a 21-inch wheel, and it still does not have a 21-inch wheel. It's really splitting the difference between adventure touring, leaning into adventure styling, and more often than not, really leaning into what I would categorize as a sport touring functionality with some adventureness dabbling, we'll say.
Right. If you need to go down a dirt road to go see something when you're out on a trip, you can take it down there without worrying that you're going to pit everything on it with the rocks or, you know, do damage just riding it off road. So it gives you that. The great thing about adventure bikes is it gives you that touring ability, along with the ability to just, like I said, go down a dirt road to go see something you want to see and not have to worry too much about that activity.
Of course, there are more hardcore adventure motorcycles from, you know, KTM, Ducati, et cetera, et cetera. And really, you're going to be looking at bikes that have true long travel suspension. So something up in that, you know, between 8 to 10 inch suspension travel, 21 inch wire spoke wheels. With this, we have a 19 inch front and 17 inch rear, single sided swing arm, and of course, shaft driven per, you know, Moto Guzzi's overall, just, you know, that's their design philosophy that really has been instituted since 1965 when they adopted the what they call the transverse V-twin. And of course, it uses a shaft drive or cardan drive, depending on your preferred nomenclature. And it's something that really has become intrinsic with the brand overall. But yeah, like we said, is this the most hardcore adventure bike on the market? No. But what it does do is lean into that touring or sport touring lifestyle, I think, more aggressively, more authentically, and with more success than probably a lot of bikes in this adventure touring category. So at any rate, that's kind of the baseline for the Stelvio. So what do you want to talk about first?
Well, everybody's still excited, I think, by the V100 motor. It's the, you know, it's first liquid cooled Moto Guzzi motor. And that was a big deal when it came out last year. And they've on the regular street bike, and now it's time for us to enjoy it on an adventure bike. How does that V-twin work in that format?
So talking about the engine first, it's the 1042cc 90 degree V-twin that we saw first in the V100 Mandello, which celebrated 100 years of Moto Guzzi producing motorcycles from the Mandello Dell'Aro factory, which is right on the shores of Lake Como, or at least, you know, not too far away. At any rate, it represented a massive step forward for the brand and was quite a departure from what we know Moto Guzzi to be. The interesting thing about Moto Guzzi overall is that they've really stuck to their roots, for better or worse, and they've always maintained this absolutely undeniably unique riding experience from top to bottom. But of course, what is really intrinsic to that is the V-twins. Now, Moto Guzzi has always referred to its engines as being transverse V-twin engines. And if you really want to get into the engineering definitions of what a transverse engine is, then their definition is playing fast and loose with that terminology.
Well, for me, it's a transverse top end and a longitudinal bottom end.
Yeah, because the definition relates to the crank orientation, which is in line with the chassis instead of crossing the chassis. So that's the Moto Guzzi terminology. That's their explanation. For our purposes, we're just going to call it a V-twin because, well, that's what it is. In terms of the technological advancements and why it's super significant for Moto Guzzi, is it marked a lot of firsts for the brand. It was the first engine to use a finger follower valve train, so lightweight finger follower valve train. It was the first engine from the brand to use water cooling. It also boasts the highest horsepower that we've seen in quite a long time from the brand. So it features 115 horsepower and 77 foot-pounds of torque. There's clutch upgrades, you know, numerous upgrades to the cardan drive or shaft drive, whatever your preferred nomenclature is there. But realistically, it is a, you know, state-of-the-art technology-laden engine from a brand that has always stayed quite true to its roots in terms of design, function, riding experience, and everything else that coincides with that. But if you look at the V-twin as it stands, despite it being extremely modern, and really how that plays out is just something that's dead smooth. I mean, just an absolutely super smooth engine. You get something that's still quite Moto Guzzi. It still has the same general architecture and design layout that we're familiar with the brand. So as you mentioned before, you have those jugs that are jutting out of the side, creating that classic eagle silhouette, which is sort of indicative of every Moto Guzzi. But there's a lot of other niceties that are, you know, in play here with the fact that the jugs themselves are actually flipped 90 degrees. So the manifolds are now exiting out of the side instead of the front, which also helps relocate the throttle bodies to the interior of the V. The engine itself is actually canted 5 degrees forward. So we're getting more performance, but all these other little changes are actually creating more room for our knees and creating more comfort. And in my opinion, it also actually helps out with heat dissipation because now you're not having the exhaust headers just sitting in the front and kind of blowing hot air back on the rider. And realistically, it's like this engine is sort of primed for the sport touring and adventure touring category because that 115 horsepower and 77 foot-pounds torque that we mentioned earlier, it's a very gentlemanly, 115 horsepower and 77 foot-pounds of torque. It makes about 82% of its peak torque, from about 3,500 RPM. And then you have this broad power band that just pulls all the way up to, its upper regions of the revs and delivers just easy to use, very gentlemanly power. It's not going to shock you, but what it is going to do is keep you engaged and also have, a very streetable amount of grunt that you can really lean into and just, you still get that classic Guzzi character too. Now, one of the other really cool things that they've done with this engine is add a secondary counter-rotating crankshaft. And not to confuse listeners that might be familiar with that technology from MotoGP or what's currently in some Ducati and MV Agusta sport bikes, that counter-rotating crankshaft is used for improving handling and also a mechanical sort of wheelie control mechanism because it prevents it helps prevent excessive wheeling. At any rate, the reason the Moto Guzzi's V-twin engine is using a secondary counter-rotating crankshaft is to lessen that sort of tug that you'll feel with any Guzzi engine because the cylinders are transverse mounted, we'll say, instead of being in line with the chassis. And it's something that you can also experience on boxer engines too. So BMWs, you can do the same thing when you're sitting in neutral and the gearbox is neutral and you rev the engine, you'll feel either Guzzi's or BMWs kind of tug to one side. And with the V100 engine, the 1042cc engine, that isn't entirely eliminated. It's just subdued to the point where it will never influence handling to any degree. Because if you think about older Moto Guzzi, say the V7 or V85, things like that, when you're really, really opening the throttle aggressively or closing it aggressively, that actually can influence the chassis to a certain degree. But that's kind of the engine in a nutshell. And yeah, it's definitely a sweet little thing that's well suited for the sport touring and adventure touring classes.
Okay, so this is an advanced motor from Moto Guzzi, which is, I think we're all happy to see. Does it have things like ride modes and an IMU and ride by wire? Is it that advanced or is it just water cooled?
Yes, it's definitely, with the whole narrative, it's following, that technological, logical pathway. So it does have various ride modes. It is ride by wire throttle. It does have an optional quick shifter for the Stelvio. The quick shifter is standard on the V100 Mandello S, so the up-spec model, but it's an option here. And a quick note with the Stelvio in particular, Moto Guzzi felt it was a good idea to upgrade the clutch system going from the V100 to the Stelvio. And actually, these upgrades are going to affect both bikes coming into 2024. So when we rode the V100 about a year and change ago, we noticed that at certain RPMs, the shifting could be a bit clunky. back then we observed that it may be just, you know, some sort of algorithmic smoothing that needs to go on with the up down quick shifter, maybe a little bit of kind of clunkiness between that and the shaft drive, which isn't entirely unheard of if you compare the characteristics of a shaft drive to a chain final drive. Things can be in certain cases not as smooth comparatively, but there's really no argument in terms of the ease of use and less maintenance that you have to perform with a shaft drive. That said, with the Stelvio and 2024 V100, they updated the slipper clutch. They improved the damping springs. They also added a new shift drum and reworked the actual manufacturing of the gearing. So the gear ratios are the same based on what the, you know, information was provided from Moto Guzzi, but the actual machining of the gears is a little bit different. So what that did for the Stelvio is actually improve the shifting overall. On the, we'll start in a little bit different direction. The downshift or auto blip when you're using the optional $250 quick shifter, that is spot on. That's darn near perfect at this point. On the V100, you could definitely throw it for a loop if you were too aggressive with it, you know, at certain RPMs. It definitely wasn't a big fan of that. It wanted a bit more thought out shifting strategy, which honestly kind of worked for that bike's personality. You know, would you really be banging down multiple consecutive downshifts on a V100? Probably not. But if you were to do it, it wasn't the biggest fan of it. Likewise, the upshift on the V100 could be a bit clunky depending on the RPM you're at, as well as the throttle opening. They've definitely taken a positive step in shifting for the Stelvio. There's still a little bit of roughness or jumpiness in the earlier half of the gearbox, but it's also taken a step forward just overall. So while the gearbox isn't quite perfect yet, we do need to give credit where it's due. And honestly, it's kind of interesting because when you think about quick shifters in general, up-down quick shifters in particular, the auto blip or downshift function, that's usually the one that manufacturers struggle to get right. And in this case, it's done very well. Now, going into the rest of the electronics, has 5 different ride modes. Your ride modes are tour, rain, road, sport, and off-road. And they follow a pretty tried and true logic at this point. You know, tour softens things up nicely. Rain is, well, rain, and really softens things. Road is a happy middle ground. Sport is obviously the most athletic of the bunch. And off-road starts disabling the nannies and allowing you to adjust ABS to the point where you can actually turn ABS off completely. First, it allows you to do an off-road ABS that is front only. And then with another deep dive into the menu, you can kill it altogether, which is interesting because there are a handful of adventure bikes that quote unquote may be more aggressive in their off-roadiness than this one, but they don't actually allow that feature. So, you know, kudos to Moto Guzzi, because really there are situations when you would want to disable off-road completely. And depending on your skill level as an off-road rider, you may just want to default to that anyway. Now moving along, we also have cornering ABS, lean angle sense of traction control. So all of the modern niceties that you'd really expect out of a bike like this, and, you know, a bike like this that's coming out in today's market. So Moto Guzzi is not just embracing modern technologies with the engine, they're doing it full scale, which kind of brings us into the next little technological bit with radar and all that good stuff.
Okay. Well, let's hold off on the radar until we go riding out in the road. And so the main thing I always want to know about the different modes and the different ABS settings, different traction control settings, are they ever a problem or are they mostly transparent?
No, they're mostly transparent. And because Moto Guzzi is a sister brand, or they live under the Piaggio umbrella, their sister brand is Aprilia, there's a good bit of homogeneous design, we'll say, in terms of the interface and user experience that we're seeing between everything. At this point, if you were to jump on any of the modern Aprilias, look at the TFT display, and then jump on, say, the V100 or the Moto Guzzi Stelvio, you're going to start to notice that even down to, say, the fonts, things are pretty similar. And with the ride modes and how you adjust them, and, you know, the fact that you can customize any of the ride modes. So while Tour, Rain, Road, Sport, and Off-Road are preset, they're also fully customizable, which I think is really crucial to understand and a very important thing to note. Because as we know with other brands, sometimes those are locked in and you just can't change it. And that can be either good or bad. It just depends on the situation. In this case, you really could make Rain the most aggressive mode if you wanted to, but, well, why? You know, so there's that. At any rate, the ride-by-wire setup is quite good. You have varying levels of essentially throttle maps and engine aggressiveness. And really, I stuck with the most aggressive mode, not just because I tend to enjoy sport riding and things of that nature. I think they've done a really good job with tempering this engine and positioning it and giving it a personality that matches its goals. So it's never too aggressive, even in the most aggressive modes. And it's also never too sort of docile either. It's always going to have that good kind of rich torquiness to it that will always give it a little bit of sneering attitude, you know, at any point in time. Traction control works as intended. You know, we rode in some pretty interesting areas, you know, climbed some pretty big elevations. And at one point, if I remember correctly, the dash was showing something like 37 Fahrenheit, maybe even a little bit lower, because we were at a few thousand feet. It was nice and blustery, even a bit damp. So having that TC on hand was definitely good. Now the off-road TC sets it to the lowest level overall, and the very limited time we had to kind of rip around on some groomed little kind of fire roads equivalent. You know, as long as you kept your momentum up, the TC never really piped up. But with how tractable this engine is, turning off TC altogether is not something that I would question for any rider that has a bit of experience under their belt. So if you're an intermediate rider and above, turning off TC with the amount of horsepower you have at hand, with how tractable that power delivery is, I'd say you're pretty golden. Whereas, would I make that same claim against something that's a lot more hardcore than this, something like the 1290 Super Adventures? Maybe not. Yeah. But yeah, the electronics work. They're, you know, they're not basic by any stretch of the imagination. I think the UI is pretty user-friendly. And so they're technologically advanced. They get the job done, and they're not overly complicated. So there you go.
Okay, so let's go riding. Tell me, you know, when I see a new bike like this, I always get excited, but I don't always get to ride it right away. And sometimes you ride it first. And what's the bike like to ride in, you know, in the twisties in the mountains when you're going on that adventure tour where, you know, most of it's going to be on the street? And so what's that experience like? How does that bike feel?
So like the V100, it sort of looks a bit bigger in photos than it actually seems. That can also come across with a lot of adventure touring or just adventure bikes overall. You know, because, well, they're large motorcycles, especially when you're staring at them, you're like, yeah, that's a tall, kind of wide, big thing. Now, in terms of weight, the Stelvio tips the scales without bags at a claimed 542 pounds. So it's, you know, not the lightest thing in the world, not the heaviest thing in the world by any stretch of the imagination. If you start thinking about, you know, leader class GSs that are fully loaded to the hilt, you're going to be looking at deep into the 500s, if not almost 600 pounds. But without getting too far off track, they've really done an excellent job with the handling, which is something that we noted on the V100. There's definitely a lot of Aprilia-ness that is showing through in this Moto Guzzi. And I wouldn't say that is a bad thing at all. Aprilia is known for sport bike chassis, won plenty of championships. You know, they're in MotoGP. And a lot of that influence is definitely trickling down as the two brands are doing a lot more communication in terms of engineering than they may have done in the past. So with the Moto Guzzi, Stelvio in particular, the thing that they really wanted to stress to us is that the V100 Mandello sport touring bike and the Stelvio adventure touring bike, they were designed in parallel. So although they were released at different times, because brands need to release things in a staggered format, just so they have, you know, stuff to lean on as the years go on. They were designed simultaneously. So the chassis for the Stelvio is different from the V100. It has four mounting points. It's also said to be over 20% stiffer. The card and drive housing itself, it has grown from 5 millimeter thickness to 7 millimeter thickness, really just to give it a little bit more rigidity and durability in off-road situations. So there are a handful of changes there, but the seating position and the riding experience is going to be pretty indicative of that very neutral, upright riding position, that all day riding position that we're looking for with adventure touring motorcycles or sport touring motorcycles. So it's quite comfy and spacious. It also is really narrow between the knees. So the seat height overall, if we check our numbers down at the spec sheet, which is on ultimatemotorcycling.com, if you ever want to reference that, the seat height, the sided seat height is 32.7 inches. Now, because of all the strategies that they've employed with the card and drive, angling the shaft drive inward, right at the tank and seat seam, that's a number that my 32-inch inseam can negotiate quite easily. So I can get my boots on the deck and everything's pretty much happy days from there. So it's a really narrow motorcycle, and Aprilia has done a good job of that, you know, over the years with a great many of their bikes. As far as the handling goes, like I mentioned before, that's where a lot of that Aprilianess shines through. And despite the fact that we're running skinnier and larger, or a larger front wheel, the thing handles impeccably well. I think, though, you know, the engine and the handling, those are the two standout traits for the Stelvio when I rode it. It's interesting because I actually feel like it handles a little bit better than the V100, simply because it has a higher center of gravity, which allows you to manipulate the bike a bit easier, we'll say. So the thing doesn't handle too spirited, nor is it too subdued. It's really, really creates some parity between its gentlemanly engine behavior and also handling characteristics. And before long, you're kind of trail breaking into corners and riding a bit more aggressively, not because, you know, that may be your riding style, just because it encourages you to do so, because it is so planted, it is so stable. And it also extends the wheelbase a little bit more than the V100 overall, something like over an inch. I think it might even be like an inch and a half or something like that. I need to double check those numbers. At any rate, so you have a chassis that's a bit more rigid. You also have a longer wheelbase, really, really leans into the stability of the motorcycle overall. And that's with something that is taller, has more travel, has a higher center of gravity. And a lot of these things don't necessarily equate to excellent handling bikes. But in the case of the Stelvio, that's where its touring aspect is underscored, not just once, not just twice, probably 3, 4, 5 times 6 over, whatever you want to do in terms of our, you know, overzealous emphasis on that point. But that's the point I'm trying to get across here.
Okay. So a big part of a touring bike is how fatiguing it is. Is this bike easy to ride? Do you have to muscle it around because it, you know, it's not a lightweight? How does it feel at the end of the day? Do you feel like you've been wrestling, you know, with a giant grease pig, or you've been riding a swan?
I would say There are situations where it's going to feel like both in terms of its road riding experience. This thing is graceful as the day is long, and great. Okay. Fair enough. So in low speed situations, it's going to be awesome. High speed situations. We got a lot of varied road conditions in Almeria, Spain. You know, as I mentioned before, we hit some elevation. We got some damp stuff, some cold stuff. I even managed to find a little patch of ice or two in the shaded sections. And then also just high-speed highway things. We did essentially everything that you do on a sport touring or adventure touring motorcycle in the course of an eight-hour day in the saddle. And I was no worse for wear. And that really speaks to the fact that it has good wind protection and also a very neutral riding position overall. So you're not being taxed aggressively. The only times that you might feel its weight are in situations where you allow it to actually kind of expose itself in that kind of capacity. So picking the bike up off the side stands, that's when you go, okay, yeah, it's a leader class motorcycle. It's carrying a lot of fuel, pretty high, etc., etc. These are all things that we can observe with bikes in this class overall. You know, because if you pick up a GS or a GS Adventure or something like that, yeah, the thing's carrying an enormous amount of fuel, like pretty high. It's not going unnoticed, right? And you can say that about a lot of different motorcycles. The GSA comes to mind because that thing has a massive, massive fuel range. This thing has a pretty massive fuel range as well. It carries, I think, 5.5 gallons. Yeah, 5.5 gallons. Yeah, that is in a motorcycle market where fuel tanks tend to be the first things that get slashed in order to save weight. And that's definitely becoming a trend in the recent years. 5.5 gallons of fuel is a lot of fuel. So your touring capacity is underscored again. So yeah, the main thing here is, no, this bike is not taxing on the road in the least bit. And that's a combination of one, it's pretty excellent handling overall. And of course, then you have the neutral riding position and the electronically adjustable windscreen that can go up and down just at the touch of a button. So it's really poised and built to crush miles. And it does that excellently. Now that's going to segue us into radar. Well, this is a complicated thing. And we need to, I don't want to belabor the point and, go into too much detail, because really these radar systems work more or less in line with what we've seen on competitors and also what's pretty common in the automotive market. If you've driven a car or truck that's been released in the past 10 years, a lot of these features are, I don't want to say commonplace, but I think they're pretty much commonplace at this point. At least we can back it up to 5 years. I think every single car that's been released in the past 5 years has most of these features. At any rate, there's something to understand with the full name of the...
Oh, don't go there. No, I don't.
The Piaggio Fast Forward Rider Assistance Solution. Okay, so it's called PRFRAS.
Because when I'm sitting around with my friends, I'm always saying, well, the PFFRAS on my bike.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a 4D radar system, so you have front and rear radar. We've seen that with the Yamaha Tracer 9 GT Plus, the Ducati Multistrada V4. I think it's on the V4S, actually, and some of the other ones. Anyway, whatever.
Plenty of premium motorcycles.
Yeah, premium bikes have this. Now, that is a $1,000 option on the Stelvio that you need to purchase, with the bike. So for all intents and purposes, there actually are two separate models of the Stelvio. There's one with the radar and one without, because it would be cost prohibitive and just too invasive to add this stuff on as an option after point of sale, because really the whole front end of the motorcycle is different from the one that has radar and the one that doesn't.
Right. If you want radar, it has to come from the factory that way.
Yeah, it has different plastics. It has, you know, different windscreen even. You know, some of the other core components are different to accept this stuff. And so, yeah, the production assembly lines might be 95% the same for the Stelvios, but that last bit where they install the radar, that separates the two bikes. And to be clear, there aren't two separate models of the Stelvio. It's just you either buy one with it or one without it. Okay. So we all kind of know what radar does. Overall, you're going to get things like adaptive cruise control. You're going to get a forward collision warning system, blind spot detection, lane change assist. Now, Piaggio calls those things their own little proprietary name, just as every other brand on the market does. But those are the four key things that we're getting with this. And to be clear, adaptive cruise control is not an option in our market. That's just you get it overall. Other markets, they have their things. That's fine. That's their problem. For us, you know, in North America, when you get the radar system, you get everything. Okay, good, done, great. Now, unfortunately, because of that reality with this or adaptive cruise control being an option, we didn't get to test it because our bikes didn't have that function installed for whatever reason. Don't know, don't care. That's just the way it is. Them's the brakes. So what we're going to talk about here is the forward collision warning system, blind spot detection, and lane change assist. So kind of like the same way it would in a car or on competitor bikes, it throws up a variety of warnings when the radar detects that you're closing in on something too quickly and, you know, the closing speed is becoming a problem. So it throws up a warning on the dash and then eventually an audible beep, as well as an even more obvious warning on the dash if you're really too close. And I actually got it to trigger when we were riding off road, just because we're in really close proximity to each other. And I passed a fellow journalist, not in an aggressive way. I just passed him relatively close.
Oh, come on, you roosted him.
No, it's like, but didn't have the opportunity actually. So it's just I remember pulling out of the off the road and then into this little kind of dirt area that we shot some photos in, and just he was still messing with his dash and I took off, and it's just the fact that I got close to him, you know, within we'll say like a bike width away, and that it triggered the system to where it actually made the beep. And I was like, oh, okay, because you could see the trigger or the system being triggered when you're riding in close formation. It would just throw up the warnings like, hey, you're close to something. You should probably not crash into it. And a lot of these systems are a little bit overzealous with their sort of nervous nature, we'll say. You can trigger them pretty easily. But, you know, one of the things that we do want to note here is that it's not going to stop the bike for you, because although it has radar, it doesn't have radar linked braking. So it's not going to actually do anything in terms of stopping the motorcycle, which on a lot of cars, you know, you do have emergency collision detection and things like that, and it'll just straight up stop. But this is a bike, you can't exactly just stop.
Does it cut the throttle?
It only influences bike speed when you have adaptive cruise control engaged. And the only thing it uses to manage distance and speed is it starts adjusting engine braking essentially. So for an adaptive cruise control situation, that's actually fine if you're on the freeway and you think about the use case and you just think about the bike managing a gap to the vehicle ahead of it. In most cases, just managing a, you know, throttle position and engine braking would be enough, unless it's an emergency situation and then you need to stop. That said, you know, that does leave an opportunity to take things further with Moto Guzzi and do radar linked braking strategies that we can see in some of the competition. But okay, cool, whatever. Maybe it'll happen soon, maybe it won't, who knows. But blind spot detection. So in your rearview mirrors, you have these little indicators. If someone comes up in your rear, kind of what would that be, your rear three quarter zone behind you, It'll make you aware that, hey, something is there. If you turn on your indicator and someone happens to be in that zone, it will flash furiously to, again, make you aware that you don't necessarily want to change lanes at this time. And this is one of those systems that's kind of an interesting mental experiment because it can be pretty overzealous, especially when you're riding in tight formation, because essentially something is always going to be detected by the radar. So in a way, you can start ignoring it. But if you actually engage with the system, it's something that takes a little bit of training mentally to, one, look in the mirror, acknowledge something that you're like, okay, I've looked in the mirror, I'm checking to see if I can make a safe lane change. And then the second step is, oh, now I can look at this little indicator to see really what's going on without cranking my head over. So generally when I ride, I look in the mirror, give myself a check, move over. Now I've added a third little step. And if that system works and prevents me from getting clobbered by another bike or car or whatever, then I guess it's paid for itself. You know what I mean? You know, because the alternative is a crashed bike and or human. And I feel like that's a lot more expensive than $1,000. Just my personal opinion.
Yeah. There's no way to turn off the lane change assist warning.
No.
In California, where we lane split, obviously that's going to be on all the time.
I would need to actually see how it works in that situation. We did a little bit of lane splitting, you know, and what's interesting is a lot of the time when we're on these press rides, we don't necessarily just sit there and filter through traffic because we're always riding at essentially the opposite of rush hour, or we're riding in areas where we don't really get to do that. So that's a question that I would want to, I'd actually need to confirm that, you know, back at home. But for me, the blind spot detection is actually something that holds value. And it is something that you do need to train your mind to a little bit. But here's the important thing. If you're not interested in this technology, you can just not buy it. So you know, it's kind of a silly thing to point out, but when you think about a lot of cars and bikes of today, some of those features are thrust on consumers, whether they like it or not. So they're buying something that they may not have an interest in. For me, I think there's going to be buyers of the Stelvio that go all in for the technology because they're a guy or gal that's like, no, I want all the stuff because this is cool. And technology is that, you know, this is what I want on my bikes. But I also think there's a contingent of buyers, you know, and perhaps Moto Guzzi owners that won't be interested in that. And giving them a more affordable door to open is not a bad thing, because when you think about the Yamaha or the R18, or I think it is an option on the R18, but certainly the Multistradas, that's not an option anymore. It's just, it is. So there you go.
Right. Okay. So I think we've handled the street aspect of it pretty much. I want to touch on the dirt part. Not, you know, we know that you didn't ride it in the dirt a lot, which I think reflects the average Moto Guzzi Stelvio owner. This isn't the kind of bike you're going to buy if you're going to be doing a lot of hardcore off-road riding. And from the looks of the pictures, you didn't have hardcore off-road knobby style tires either. So how was it on the gravel roads that you traversed?
Yeah, I think we need to be very clear about adventure riding at its core. I think there are a handful of different adventure riders. You have people that are just finishing out the last mile. You have people that just really like the adventure aesthetic and use them as sport touring and commuting bikes and things like that, and will never touch the dirt. Then you have another buyer that is genuinely slamming these things off-road. And if you're that type of buyer, well, then you're going to be going for something with a 21-inch front wheel, a lot more suspension travel, a lot more ground clearance, ostensibly probably lighter weight, just something that's a lot more off-road oriented. So this isn't a knock against the Stelvio in the sense that, oh, it can't keep up with a Aprilia Touareg 660 in the dunes. Well, my friend, I am disappointed. No, they just do different things, and we need to be cognizant of that. So one of the first signs of that is the fact that you're dealing with upgraded suspension in terms of the V100, you know, when you're talking about just travel. So the suspension travel is 6.8 inches front and rear. That is more than the V100. It's semi-adjustable suspension. So you have a preload and rebound only. That's kind of one of the nitpicks I have about this bike is at this price point, I think fully adjustable suspension would have been a well worth, you know, added feature, but it is what it is. The suspension works well, especially on the road. For the off-road situations, we pretty much hit a little gravel run to go and snag some photos. And then towards the end of the day, Moto Guzzi left us to our own devices on this little beachfront area right in Almeria. So we actually got to do a lot more riding, you know, between my colleagues and I, just kind of run around, slide, you know, do some silly stuff and have some fun, you know, under our own recognizance, we'll say. And the thing is, look, 6.8 inches of travel, 542 pounds. Look, it's not out of the realm of possibilities that you're going to use all of that travel fairly quickly. Now, one of the cool things that they did add for this bike is you have a remote preload adjuster for the shock, so you don't have to break out tools to, you know, adjust shock preload when you're adding luggage or passengers or yada, yada, yada. But just based on visual stuff, we can get the idea that the Stelvio is more of a road bike. It does not have enormous amounts of travel and clearance. That's cool. But you're on these, you know, groomed trails, we'll say.
Roads.
Yeah. 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 Let's be clear about what I envision this bike doing. Fire roads, groomed two track trails, dirt roads, things like that, you know, your last mile type of riding to get to, we'll say campgrounds or, you know, very, very tame, fire roads, things like that, stuff where you're not necessarily bump jumping the thing or doing rock scrabbling crawls, you know, hill climbs, et cetera, et cetera. You're just adventuring. And that's really, I think, speaks to the clear majority of adventure riders. Because again, there is the hardcore sect, but they're going to be going for a different bike. And
right,
really, really underscore it. All of those hardcore off-road motorcycles cannot do what this bike can do on the street. So you're choosing your use cases and running with it. Now, it does have a beefier fork. It uses a 46 mil instead of a narrow fork that's on the V100. Again, that's just to deal with the weight when it's getting bounced around off-road in any capacity. It doesn't matter if you're hitting a groomed fire road or actually trying to jump the thing. It's going to help out. Okay.
Oh, one thing my pet peeve, I will say, on adventure bikes like this is when they have manually adjustable suspension. Because if you have the suspension set up for the street, it's not going to be set up for off-road at all. And this bike has no electronic suspension adjustments. Now, I'm not talking about semi-active suspension, which is fairly complex. I would just like to have a button that changes the settings so I don't have to get off, get a screwdriver out, start. And if I need to experiment, I have to stop every time, turn a clicker, do this. I'd like to have, you know, something from the dash, something that my thumb operates and I can change. So I'd like to, you know, take this opportunity to tell all the manufacturers listening that we don't need necessarily semi-active suspension on an adventure bike like this, but we want electronically adjustable suspension and even better electronically adjustable suspension that is linked to the ride modes. And so I think on this Moto Guzzi, there's definitely room for them to grow into that sort of sophistication.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we did talk about with engineers. We asked, you know, hey, the V100 Mandello S features semi-active all-in suspension. Why isn't this in play here? Because for me, sport touring motorcycles, more so than any other class, are primed for semi-active suspension. If you think about everything that a sport touring bike or an adventure touring bike does, the fact that it's going to do essentially a little bit of everything, you go, man, that would be pretty awesome to have, just so you can click around a little bit and then change the bike's entire characteristic. You can make it as soft as you want it or as firm as you want it, depending on your needs. And essentially they said, look, it's kind of a pricing issue. And if the market calls for it, we're going to add it. So at this time, no, but that doesn't mean it can't happen in the future, which I think is a pretty honest take on it. You know, some manufacturer representatives may not be as forthcoming with that information. And yeah, you know, getting to the price point was very important for Moto Guzzi to not exceed something that they saw as sort of too high for this bike. So it's something that they were very aware of. And I think that's how that played out in terms of the suspension. But again, if they see that there's a big demand for it, then they're going to add it, because obviously Moto Guzzi is familiar with it on the V100 Mandello S, and then Aprilia has instituted semi-active suspension for many, many years. Now, in terms of the electronically adjustable suspension, which is you're kind of threading a needle between semi-active and then just, you know, adjusting the preload electronically, which is on a handful of bikes. I think the most recent one that I rode was the Tiger 900 GT, that the shock is can be adjusted electronically.
Yeah, I'm not looking for like the automatic preload adjustment, which is, again, a fairly sophisticated thing. I'm just saying you could change the damping, you know, with a button rather than twiddling the knobs.
Yeah. Basically just taking tools out of the equation.
Right. Or not even tools, but manually doing it. I still don't even want clickers that I have to use by hand. I want it electronically handled so I can do it while I'm riding and I can just hit a button. I have stiffer suspension or I have softer suspension. BMW was kind of the first to bring out that feature. And that was before semi-active suspension. And so what they had was that you could adjust the suspension by, you know, yourself, but you could do it electronically. And, you know, sure, semi-active suspension is great. It costs more. This would give you the ability to do it yourself. You know, it's kind of just like a less expensive way to get that functionality of at least being able to change it, even if it's not changing 1,000 times a second as it is with semi-active suspension.
And at this point, I'd almost be wondering if semi-active, because it's become more common, if that's the more affordable route to go. But anyway, that's a question for another day. So yeah, semi-active, not here right now, but stands to reason that if the market sees fit, it'll happen. So that's where we're at. And that also does kind of wrap up the off-road discussion. It's like, look, this thing can do it as long as you keep it reasonable. When you start jumping it, when you start putting it in the really soft stuff, then you'll notice that, okay, it can get a little bit top heavy. Again, 5.5 gallons of fuel kept up high is nothing to sneeze at. And these are observations that I would apply to the clear majority of leader class adventure touring motorcycles. This is not something that I apply to this one in exclusivity, we'll say.
To me, I'm listening to this, and it's a super versatile bike on road, off road. It has that limited use of let's say any road short of what a 4x4 would be required on, you know, for that kind of thing. And one last thing we didn't talk about were the bags. Did you have? I see the pictures that you had bags on the bike. How do they go on and off? That's usually my main concern when I have a bike like that.
Yeah. So just like the V100 Mandello, the Stelvio uses the same integrated mounting system. The mounted system is actually pretty cool, because you just pop off the passenger seat and then the whole thing kind of fits in there in place. You don't have to buy additional luggage racks or bolt things on, do anything. When you buy a Stelvio, the bags are optional, which part of me thinks, with a bike like this, it should be, you know, baked into the price, you know, whatever they may be. The luggage itself is an $850 option. I would be purchasing that from day one, just because, look, if I'm going to get an adventure touring bike, probably going to tour. Okay. That's a good buy in my book. There's also other options with heated seats, heated grips. The quick shifter is an option that we mentioned before. That's $250. There's also a center stand available, $230. Bluetooth connectivity, if you want to, you know, connect your phone and do navigation, that's $280. They've really gone a la carte with their various options, again, to keep the price at that $16,390 MSRP base level. And then it's $1,000 for the radar as well.
One other question I had about touring. How is the windscreen adjustable? I assume it's not electronically adjustable, but is it adjustable by hand or do you need tools?
No. We mentioned earlier that it is electronically adjustable. So you cycle through the menu and raise it up or down, just like the V100, quite a spiffy little feature. That's standard, not an option. So whether you're talking about the bike with the radar or without, even in the lowest position, so I'm at 5'10", even in the lowest position at a spirited pace in the canyons, I wasn't getting a lot of buffeting or anything like that. In the upright position, you're still getting enough wind flow to where you're not creating kind of an overly warm cockpit. I think we need to explain that a little bit more, but you know what I mean when you ride touring bikes with just enormous windscreens that truly do block out positive airflow. So even in the upright position with an ADV helmet, you know, it's pretty cozy overall. I mean, we mentioned that it has a neutral riding position. It's a very comfortable motorcycle. In terms of wind protection, you have a lot more fairing up front than most Moto Guzzis typically have, which are pretty stripped down. So your knees are well protected. You have, you know, the adjustable windscreen. You also have cornering headlights. It's a pretty well sorted motorcycle, even if the other stuff are kind of kept as, options. Because you did touch on the bags. I couldn't figure out a way to get my ADV helmet in the bags. That said, I'm kind of a light packer and I really dig these bags because I first experienced them on the V100 Mandello. I think the locking mechanisms and the latching system is pretty sweet overall. And the fact that you don't have to bolt things on and, you know, physically change anything is a big benefit. So yeah, that's where we're at with that one.
Okay. Well, when the intro for this came down, I was jealous because I wanted to go. But because of the time of another intro, you were already going to be in Europe. So it made sense for you to go ride it first. And so I'll have to wait my turn, which is never fun. But it sounds like it was a great bike to ride.
No, it's for its purpose. This is a welcome return for the Stelvio namesake. Because you know what we all kind of said after riding it was, man, like they got rid of this thing and it's awesome. You know, granted, this Stelvio compared to the old one is totally different.
Yeah. I mean, do you ever ride the old Stelvio?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a number of years, but.
Okay. So you're familiar. That was kind of a tank.
Yeah. She was a big girl.
Yeah. It was a tank. And yeah, I did a couple of off-road things on it where I regretted where I was, but on the road, good bike. But obviously, but this is a completely different planet of motorcycle, which you would expect almost, you know, 8 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a different thing. Really, its chops are going to lay in that adventure sport touring kind of thing. The hardcore stuff, look, there's other models. And Aprilia can sell you a Touareg if that's your bag. But at the end of the day, you're getting a bike that can do pretty much anything on the street and then also finish out, you know, the last mile to the campground, go to the, you know, that watering hole that's way out there. We have a couple of those in California where you have to take some dirt roads to that, rustic bar and grill at the end of the trail, so to speak.
Right.
And yeah, it to me, the two standout things here are the engine and the handling. Because with the larger diameter wheels, that we see in this class, handling can definitely take a hit. But in recent years, there's been a crop of motorcycles that have really improved the handling. And now it's tough to say that a 17-inch wheeled bike would do much better than this. So that's kind of where we're at. And so the Moto Guzzi Stelvio is definitely following that more recent trend of big wheeled bikes, adventure styled bikes that aren't giving up much, if anything, against their more road focused cousins. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at.
Okay. Well, like I said, I'm jealous. I can't wait to ride it myself, take it off on a long ride somewhere. And anyway, thanks for sharing your Spanish adventure on the Italian motorcycle. And till next time.
Yeah, that's it.
In the second segment this week, Associate Editor TJ Adams chats with Ray Hammonds. Despite his mature age, a couple years ago, Ray realized a long-time dream to learn how to ride a motorcycle. To say that he jumped in with both feet is somewhat of an understatement. Ray was fortunate enough to attend the YCRS Champ School when he first got his license, and interestingly, he credits the school with saving his life almost immediately. The topic of whether you should cover the brake when riding is actually quite controversial, and if you do it during an MSF course, you will fail. This is patently wrong, and Ray is clearly hoping the right people wake up and this change is made to rider training across the country. We'll see.
When I was in college with my best friend, Greg, he was my roommate. Well, we got to be best friends. He was my roommate in college in my sophomore year. And we were both in ROTC together. And we were sitting in a dorm one night just talking about, hey, what would we like to do? And we were talking like, okay, well, after college and we get commissioned, let's buy motorcycles and ride out west and learn how to ride and take a long trip. And well, life happens. He got married, graduated, and he got married before he graduated, and then he graduated. Then I graduated, and actually graduated before him. And then we just kept in, we've been friends for 38 years, and it always come up. And every time we're together talking about trips we want to do, and trips, we've done father daughter trips together. We went to the Bahamas and Chicago and we did all the shopping trips with our daughters. And then we were talking one night, hey, are we ever going to ride out west? And it just continued for, until the kids got out of school and they're on their own, kind of. And we said, now's the first time and we can do it. And so 2 years ago, or maybe 3 years ago, we put orders on bikes, and a friend of mine got hurt pretty bad on a motorcycle. And I was like, wow, maybe we shouldn't do that. And so we backed off and the next year we were on vacation and we're talking about, hey, we need to do this. And I finally said, listen, we're either going to do this trip or we're not. And we're going to mark it off our list and we're never going to talk about it again because we've been talking about it for 38 years. And Greg also is our my director of HR here, so vice president of HR. He's been, here for, I guess, 12 years now or longer. So we were in Florida. We took the MSF class, and I failed the first time because I was on a really small bike, and I'm 6'4", and I think I was sharing with you the struggles I had with being on a small demo bike or whatever class bike. Making a U-turn when you're 6'4" on a small bike's not a lot of fun. So I was able to muster through it the second time and got past October of 2022. I turned 57 last February, and I'm going to be 58 this February. So I was 56 at the time, so I had bought my GS 1250 and brought it back down to Orlando. And so I officially had my MSF license for 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
So this is your first big bike and you trailered it to these this the street school.
Yes, I went to the street school, yes. And it was a half a day seminar. It was a half a day school. It wasn't their full street school that they do at Champs. It was in an open parking lot. It was to get people interested in Champs school, I believe, or better riding techniques. I was taught never to touch the front brake. You look, you slow down, you do all your braking in a straight line, you press, you look, and then you go to the throttle. So coming back from Champ School, we had a warm day in November, and I'm out riding out by my house. And before I left Champ School or Champ Street School that day, was EZ, one of the instructors, told me the, hey, Ray, whenever you get that pit in your stomach, or you're coming up to a red light, or you're coming up to an intersection, roll off the throttle and roll onto the brakes so that you would be prepared to stop, not actually start pressing the brake. So I said, okay. So we have this crazy turn down this road called Sleepy Hollow here. And it's kind of a blind spot. And coming across the blind spot was a F-350 with lawn mowing equipment. And he was across the yellow line. And just rolling my fingers off of it, coming up to it, I was able to miss the truck. In my perception of what I learned at MSF class, if I would have done what they had said, I would have probably been an emblem on an F-350.
If you hadn't had that advice from
Easy.
Easy, this instructor, you'd have been going along in the way you've been taught at the New Learner School, and you wouldn't have been prepared to brake.
Right. I would have been going to the throttle at the worst possible time, because
Right.
it would have made the bike run straight like it's supposed to, and I would have been adding throttle at the worst possible time.
Well, that's an eye-opener. Yeah, and as I mean, you're a brand new rider then, so that's ringing a bell with me, because I did a new learner course, and I, like you, we were told to get everything over with before you make a turn or a bend,
Right.
and yeah, also use the back brake and not the front brake. But when I started riding with people, obviously I was told, to use the front brake, and then when I actually went to must have been the same people. I went to Yamaha Champ School for work to go and see what they were doing, and they were appalled at what I'd been taught. They told me, well, at first of all, they showed me how a motorcycle works and why you need to apply the front brake to bring your weight forward, and then you have control over the motorcycle. So I learned a different way around to what I was taught at the New Learner School.
Exactly. And that's what I learned in that instance. And I learned by going, I go back to that class a lot. I'm so into motorcycle safety that I take my management team, my friends, and I really won't ride with anybody who doesn't know how to trail brake or has not been to that school or a similar school, because it's horrifying to see your friends go across the yellow line because they don't know how to control the bike.
Yes, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So you started taking everybody you knew
Yes.
back to the Yamaha school, the Yamaha ride.
And I'm fortunate enough, I pay for them, because just to learn the technique and to know that I have a technique that will save my life and not share it with a friend of mine seems kind of,
That would be weird,
yeah,
of
it would be
course.
weird, especially if something happened.
Oh yes,
I'd
you'd
feel
feel
awful
so
for you forever.
responsible.
Yeah, I'd feel awful forever, especially when it's something that is so easy to learn and so vital to being safe on a motorcycle is trail braking, going into a trail. And the other thing that got me, and this is the only sport or recreation, I was thinking about it, that for some reason we classify racers and average day riders as different people. When I take a pro lesson at my golf school, when I go take a golf lesson, I don't go, oh, that's something the pros use because they can hit the ball 400 yards. It's the same technique that they're using to hit the ball 400 yards that I'm hitting 200 and whatever, 275 yards or 300. But it's not, but for motorcyclists, for some reason, we say, oh, that's only for the pros. You know, that's only for guys who are racing, you know, like taking turns using trail braking. I hear it so much that, hey, that's only what those racers use. That's racing stuff.
Trail braking, I was thinking, well, a lot of people might not even know what that is. It does sound like a race term, but.
Two things that trail braking allows you to do. It slows you down. It gives you speed and direction into the turn. It allows you to make a turn easier into, gives you the bike controls. And, you know, the only two controls we have in a turn is our lean and our braking. And lean is risk. The more I lean the bike over, the more I'm at jeopardy of sliding or having an accident. So I want to use my controls that I have, that the engineers have produced for us, to control the bike better. And that is using trail brake to slow my entry speed. And then with the front brakes loaded or the tire loaded, I can work the tire and then I can turn the bike easier into the corner.
So by trail braking, you're talking about keeping your brakes on while you go into a turn or a bend.
Yes, and then giving away some of the braking as you're starting to make your turn or as you got speed and direction. The biggest thing is getting the bike in the right direction and at the appropriate speed that you want to be at when you're going through a turn.
Your first bike, you said, was the GSA.
Yeah, it was a 1250 GSA. Then all my buddies ride Harley, so I bought a Road Glide, a touring bike, because we were going to begin drive out west. So I had that. I just traded that in for a CVO bike. I drove that bike in a little over 14 months. I probably had 30,000 miles. Well, I have 25,000 miles on my touring bike and probably drove about 40,000 miles this year on bikes.
Did you have to adjust your riding style? You're going from very different styles of bikes. So when you got onto the Harley Davidson, how did that feel?
The only thing, once you go through Champ School or go through any of these safety program classes, I guess, is that the only thing that I had to do was change my body position a little bit going through a turn. You know, the one thing you probably don't want to do on the street riding versus being on the track is, you know, leaning off the bike and getting your knee down. You probably don't want to try to do that on the street. Leave that for the track. But there are body positions that, you know, I can lean my head more towards the mirror that in a turn I'm going to, which will help put, you know, a lot of weight and help the bike turn.
So did you get onto a touring bike and think, well, this is not for me. It's not giving me as much fun in certain ways. Or did you still relish that experience?
I like every one of my bikes. I ride them for different reasons. Today is a nice day and I'm in Kentucky this week, and today it's 62 degrees. And after this interview, I got a brand new Ducati X out and I'm going to ride that for a couple hours and play around with that this afternoon, since it's one of the, I think next week we're supposed to have snow. So I'm leaving to go to Florida. And then at the track, I bought a couple, I really like the Ducati brand and I like BMWs a lot. And so I've been buying a couple of those, and then I've been collecting some of the Ducati's bikes. And I bought a rally. I bought the rally to do some touring in. Yeah. So I like doing all kinds of different riding. I haven't done adventure riding yet. I just don't know how fun it is to drop your bike, pick it up again in the mud, and then try to ride again in the mud. So, but I'm interested in learning, you know.
So it sounds like you've got a lot. How many motorcycles have you got now then?
I'm up like 75. I sold.
Oh, wow.
I think earlier in the year I was up about 100, and I sold a bunch off because I bought duplicate bikes. One's in Florida, so that I don't have to, you know, bikes that I really like to ride. I don't want to ship the bikes down all the time. So, and then I bought, you know, I got into being on the track. So I bought some specific track bikes over the year. And then that's got me into collecting some of those older Ducati track bikes, like the Desmo, Seducis. And I collected a couple Harley bikes. So not every bike I have are to ride. Some are just collectibles.
The ones that you're buying, do you think these internal combustion engine motorcycles are going to go up in value?
I think so. And like some, to me, just like my cars, they're artwork, you know, they're Pablo Picasso's, you know, so like some of the Desmos, I'll probably just put them in glass cases and, you know, keep them in a garage or a museum somewhere. You know, they're part of our history. They're part of how motorcycles have evolved. And they look cool.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. It seems a shame not to ride them, but then in a way you are preserving for the future generation.
I'm not saying I'm not going to ride them a little bit, but you know, some of these bikes are really set up for the track, and I would hate to have a bike like that and wreck it because I'm not good enough to ride it yet.
Interesting.
Yeah, when you hear the professionals talk about that's the one bike that scares them, you know, it kind of makes me pause a little bit. It's like getting a Porsche GT2 RS when you hear a professional driver say, that car still scares me.
Well, or if something's irreplaceable, if you're buying something that's got historical value,
Yes.
it's been ridden by a particular racer or it's got that history.
Yeah, and I've gotten into this industry. You know, I sponsor, you know, I'm part of the Graham Rahal Racing this year, where we have three riders that are going to be riding and super bikes. And I sponsored individual riders over the last year and a half, and that's been fun.
Yeah, it sounds like you've gone from being so new into the motorcycle arena to really putting your fingers out into all sorts of
You know, for me, it's been a lot
pies.
of fun. It's been a lot of fun, and I enjoy it. And you know, and again, just you know, learning how to be a better rider and enjoying what I'm doing.
It's probably a main difference between learning when you are more mature to learning to when you have that that youthful lack of respect for what might
Yes.
happen, I would say. So when you're mature, you sort of, it sounds like you have much more of a bent towards the safety side of things. And obviously you've gone through new learner classes and then these different types of classes at Yamaha Champ School that actually teach you how the motorcycles work and why you should be doing certain things and not what you've been taught just to pass the test. So you have a big interest in the safety side of things.
I am a cheerleader for Champ School, because you know it did save my life probably. And but you know, when you go to the classes and you're sitting there with the Harley engineers or the engineers from other manufacturers or the sales guys and the business development guys and all the guys who are responsible in the motorcycle industry for these bikes. You know, and you listen to what Champ School is talking about, and they defer and they ask these engineers, "Hey, is this correct?" And they all nod their head, "Yes." And it's an eye-opening event, eye-opening, you know, class when you're sitting in there, and they go, "Hey, you know, is the bike made to do this?" And you know, engineers from Harley go, "Yes." And you go, "Wow, even Harleys are made to do this." So a bike and. And this is what I try to tell my friends, the bike doesn't care or know, and this is what I got from Champ School. The bike doesn't know whether it's on the track, your local road, or touring. The bike's engineered to do what the bike is engineered to do by some of the best engineers in the world. Why not ride it like it's been made to ride? You know, I read a book and it's talked about 10,000 hours to be good at something or really good at something. And you know, that's kind of what I'm trying to be really good as fast as I can be, and going to these classes and learning as much as you can.
When you get up in the morning and decide you're going to go riding, then how on earth do you go about selecting the motorcycle that you're going to use that day? Are they all together in the same place? You go and sort of wander around
Well,
and
they are now, but this summer, what I ended up doing is like I would take one and I would just finish up the ride, and it's close to my house. And then I had like I had a bunch of motorcycles in my house, and I was like, so that was easy. But I moved them all out so I could get my cars in for the winter. So now I just go to the garage and all my stuff's there. And I usually pick something I haven't ridden in a while, or something that's new, and see, how much I'm going to like that bike, or what's the specific purpose of, like the Desert X. I'm thinking about putting road tires on it because I'm more of a road guy. I mean, I think it's got 50-50 now. But we'll see. I might keep the tires on. I'm going to ride it today. It's the first time I'm going to get to ride it. So, yeah, it just depends on what, who I'm going out with and which bike I haven't ridden a lot. My Harley guys won't let me ride my other stuff. So I generally pick one of the Harleys.
You're looking around thinking, who's feeling needy today? Who needs to go out? It's like having dogs.
Yeah. Which one needs to, which group I need to go out with? No, I'm just joking. My Harley guys, they'll jump on other bikes as well and ride. I try to stay away from the sports bikes because then that's when the horns come out and we try to go too fast through turns.
You have to be somewhere where you can, where you have the turns to ride, of course. And do you manage to test ride any of these bikes? I don't know, where are you sort of sourcing them from? Do you manage to get a test ride in before you buy them?
Yes, I do most of the time. Or I have one that's like similar. So like I have a couple of Multistradas, and then I haven't tested the Multistrada RS just came out, or RV had just come out, and I had ordered it. I haven't test rode it yet, but with Ducatis, I like the brand a lot, and they seem to, ride very well. This one's more geared to the track, so I'm interested in seeing. Well, I mean, they say it's geared to the track, but it's a multi-strata, so you can throw bags on it and go down the highway as well, or tour in it.
Sounds
So,
like the more knowledge you're getting, the more able you are to decide what you do want.
yes, yeah, it's just, I know that now I have a couple of sports bikes I'm selling. I'm just too old. I can't get in that position and stay in that position long enough to have fun. Bad knees from college basketball and high school basketball. So,
So you've gone through your sport bike phase.
yeah. That's a young man's game.
You're on fast forward here.
Yeah, I have to have upright sports bikes.
Yes, you do have to be able to get around because everything is pretty distant here in
Yeah.
America compared to
Yeah.
other places. If you're in Europe, it's more common.
Yeah, and if you go to other countries, we come back from Paris. And after I went to Paris this summer, last summer, and if you go to a foreign country and you have any bike training, you'll see that everybody's covering their brakes, when they're in traffic. I think we're the only country in the world that doesn't cover their brakes. That I've seen when I've been out, went overseas. I was in Singapore, and they cover their brakes there as well.
Yeah, well, it's crucial, but it's when you're told not to, you kind of try and do what you've been told to do, don't you? When you're taught that initially, there certainly is. I think there should be reviews of what is being taught. Myself, there should be reviews of what is being taught in order to pass this test to get your license.
Well, and again, and this is where I keep going back, and motorcycles, and even in the safety. I don't know, like the whole world has changed since 1970 or 1980 when they started the programs, or whenever they started these programs. Bikes have ABS on them now. They have a lot of different technology. I don't know if we're even teaching. I didn't learn anything about what my bike's going to feel like when ABS kicks in a safety class, and getting my license. Nobody taught me about that. Seems like that should be something that is taught, and how to prepare or how to adapt when that ABS comes in. The bikes I was running on, I don't think they had them going through the parking lot. And we found new stuff. There's new ways to go through Turn. So why not? Let's incorporate some of that and get better. To say that, hey, this is, my grandfather had a car that he had to start from the front, with, cranking it up. Well, we don't do that today, but and we don't teach people how to do that. So why are we teaching people on older stuff? Because the world has moved forward the last 50, 60 years. Let's move MSF forward so that people are getting the right stuff and getting the right training, so that they can be successful. Because we've seen a decline in motorcycle riders over the last 20 years in this country, and there's no reason for it.
I think a lot of people who do learn to ride, first of all, it's a small percentage of people compared to the people who learn to straight away to drive and get into cars. So of the people who do learn to ride, I think a lot of them do get put off because they'll have a bad experience. And that is probably down to them not being able to control the machine appropriately. So they'll suddenly grab the brakes, for instance, which you do when you're frightened or something happens, and not apply the brakes slowly because they haven't learned that way.
Yes. Or you, if you're in MSF class, they teach you how to, you don't touch your front brake, you only use your rear brake. So you're coming up to an intersection or cars are slowing based on the bike, you're only getting up to 30 or 40% of the total stopping power using your back brake. So if you then lock your back brake, you're going to start skidding and go down. So there's some things that need to be changed and taught differently. So that people don't have these issues of being scared and then not riding again. And just being a business guy, it would be better for the whole industry to come up with correct solutions going forward because, you don't buy a bike, you don't buy tires, you don't buy GPSs, and God knows why you can't get Apple CarPlay on your bikes these days, but need to continue with safety as much as we can. And
You sort of highlighted a point that we do perhaps need to, in order to keep these new motorcyclists that we want to come and expand our world, we want to get them into riding motorcycles and keep them there. I think, it might be a case in point, you're right, of addressing what is being taught to people in order just to get their licenses. They need to be taught to ride safely, in fact.
Or whatever the new technology is. I'm not, if there's something better than trail braking and the industry or the gods of engineering go, hey, this is safer, then let's teach that. Let's teach the people the new stuff and then come up with some scenario that, hey, before you actually have a full motorcycle's license, there's something else you got to do.
Yeah, not about making it difficult for people or sort of tripping people up in because people turn to motorcycles for all sorts of reasons of convenience, being nimble around cities and towns because they're at university or going to an office. So we don't want to put people in an awkward position, but just teaching them on updated methods, can be no bad thing, surely.
No, I think, anytime that you get any, for me, maybe I think of the world differently. Anytime I get any training, anytime I get any knowledge, it makes me better at everything I do. So there's a saying, and my dad used to say it as a kid, and I kind of blew it off for a while. How you do one thing is how you do everything. Fast forward, champ school, they said, hey, how you do one thing is how you do everything. And I was like, they are so right.
You didn't believe your dad, but you do believe now that you've grown up and other
I
people.
believe my dad, but I didn't want to give him the credit. So I just kind of forgot about it.
So, what do you mean by that?
Well, how you prepare to ride your bike, how you get ready to ride your bike, how you act on the bike, how you do the controls on the bike, how you think about riding. Hey, it rained last night. Am I prepared to, when I go into this turn, are there going to be road hazards maybe in the turn? Where does that road wash out that I ride all the time? Do I need to know about that? Do I need to think about that today because of the weather? Where might be leaves because I'm in Kentucky today and we still have some fall foliages on the ground. Some of the pine trees are now dropping their pines, the needles. So, So be prepared. How I do one thing is how I'm going to do everything. How I get on the bike, how I prepare for my bike ride. Do I just jump on, rev it up 4 times and off I go? Or do I think about, hey, when I leave my neighborhood, there's a stop sign, there's a red light down the road. There's going to be cars coming to the left of me, and I need to make a left-hand turn to get on my favorite road. So what's a better way to go than try to go through 4 lanes of traffic across and just things like that.
Just applying some thought instead of just being gung-ho.
Yeah. Have a plan to ride, ride to plan, and just be more thoughtful about what I'm doing on this thing that might kill me if I'm not paying attention.
So what's next, generally speaking, motorcycle wise, are you sort of constantly looking for new bikes because you're so excited about this whole thing, or do people sort of give you ideas each time you bump into another motorcycle person?
People give me ideas on new bikes that I might like, and I'm just going to enjoy being part of the race community. I'm going to see, sure I'll learn some things from that and get better understanding. But I have some bike. I've taken my bikes out to Sturgis this year. My buddy's already pinging me because the weather's warm in Florida. They want to make a ride down to Key West, so we'll probably do that in the next week or two. And then summer again, we'll probably ride 25,000-30,000 miles. I love going down the Pacific Coast Highway. This last year we cut it short. I won't say the name brand of the motorcycles, but we were riding out west and brand new bikes, and we had to spend 2 days in dealerships to get them looked at, and so that we had to cut our trip a little bit short. But I'm looking to want to do the whole Pacific Coast Highway from Washington State down to San Diego this time.
Nice.
I just like riding, and I get an itch when I can't ride. I need to ride, and I'm the guy that goes over to the garage and sits on my bike, washes it, start it up, and then do a lap. No, I can't do a lap.
Sounds like a complete love affair. So your whole life is kind of now currently rotating around.
Yeah, well, the motorcycle community is so friendly and so nice. There was a out going out to Sturgis. There were a couple motorcycles that were a little bit further behind us. I was riding with one of my buddies out there, and I looked in my rear view. I looked in the mirror, and one of these gentlemen was riding the same type of bike he was. So I was coming over. And I got in front of them, and then I noticed that my buddy's to the right of me, and I'm like, how in the world did he do that? And I'm looking out my mirror, and so I'm slowing down these guys, and I get over to the right again, and they go past, and they're part of a motorcycle gang and a club, and and I was like, oh my God, I hope I didn't cut these guys off, and luckily I didn't. And we were going to the same place, and they were cool about it, and that was pretty, for me, that was pretty interesting to see guys like that and be nice.
So you could see they were all together because they had like the same jackets or something. They had their
Yeah, they
logo.
had the same logos on the thing,
Okay.
and I said, hey, I'm sorry, I thought you were him, and I didn't realize that. And they were like, hey, no problem. It was,
So you were ready to be all intimidated because they were like looking roughy tufty, but in fact, I mean, most motorcycle guys will just, once you have a word with them, they understand.
yeah. And they was nice to be about it, and we had a laugh about it. And what I find weird about this lifestyle, this group, or whatever you want to call it, is I never hear stories of friends of mine that when they go shark diving, that, oh my gosh, my brother lost his hand, or a shark bit off his. But people who aren't even like related to people will go, hey, my third cousin on my brother's side cousin died on a bike. As people always walk up to you when you're on your motorcycle and tell you the horror stories. I've never ever had that ever happen to me in any other sport. So I don't know what that is, but or why that happens, but
Yeah, I don't know if it's just there is some sort of inbuilt fear, probably from parents not wanting their perception is dangerous. They don't, that kind of any family members or friends who've had a bad experience, it does get shared.
yeah, it's
We
like
need to share the good times.
I laugh at my friends all the time and say that'd be like me walking into McDonald's and going, "Hey, I know a buddy of mine died of a heart attack eating cheeseburgers." It's like nobody ever does that, but it seems like it's just weird when it's all kind of and I never know what to say. Like, "Oh, okay, I'm sorry about that. Let me try to get back into my." So that's where the how I do one thing is how I do everything. So when that happens, I go back and I reset my mindset onto the bike, not thinking about, hey, this guy died, 2 months ago, or this person had a crash or whatever.
Well, like you say, it happens in all walks of life and people involved in all sorts of hobbies. There's
Yeah.
always somewhere who's had a really bad experience.
But you never ever, I mean, like if you said today, and this is what I joke about, if you go, "Hey, Ray, I'm gonna go take a cruise and we're gonna go shark watching or pet a shark." You never hear of anybody go, "Oh yeah, a friend of mine got ate in a cage and a shark," or
No.
they had a really bad experience. They go, "Oh hey, have fun." But mo for some reason, motorcycles bring out the bad parts of motorcycling.
Well, the non-riders do share that. It's just becomes a fear for them, I think.
Yeah.
As I say, the reason I wanted to speak to you is because you've learned later on in life, and I didn't realize you had gone really full into the whole motorcycle lifestyle.
I like it. I kind of get upset when I can't ride and I call my friends and go, "Hey, is this normal?" Like I'm feeling like, wow, it's raining today, and kind of mad that it's raining. If and it's not today, today's beautiful, but if I go to Florida and I'm down there for a week, like 2 weeks ago, it rained for 10 days. I was like a little kid looking out the window going, "Hey, is it clear enough? How windy is it?"
You're taking it personally because you can't ride.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, that's the way it was. I got mad and I left and went home, and then it snowed. And I came back to Kentucky and it snowed here. So I was like, I should have stayed there in the rain.
So what's the bike you hanker for most? Is there something that you really want that you haven't found yet, or are you still sort of learning about so many?
Oh, I'm still learning a lot about them. Every time I hang around those guys or hang around people who ride a lot, I hear about different bikes. I'd like to collect some older Harleys just to see. I hear stories about them and just to see what they look like. And I think my oldest bike is a 2008 Desmo Seducci. So, and it's totally different and looking at it and how it's built and how it's made in the newer bike. So, it's just kind of cool to look at these things. They're art history to me, and they're history, and some of the designs and some of the new paintwork on some of the Harleys, they're like artwork to me. I mean, like some of the whiskey neats, I took them down and got them PPF'd in ceramic coating because I don't want a rock to chip them. And so it's just, yeah, I'm so new to this. I just like everything about it.
Like a kid in a candy store.
Yes, I am. It's like, hey, this is cool. Oh, that bike looks neat. What can I do with this bike? And okay, that's a track bike. Okay, let me take that one.
It sounds like also you're learning because you're going back and you're sort of doing repeat learning, I suppose. You're learning more and more. You're upskilling pretty quickly and probably getting faster and faster because that's what happens. Do you think you'll ever end up racing, There are lots of senior classes around.
I don't know. One of the guys I was in with Homestead, he said, "Hey, him and I should go get our license." And I said, I want to take some more classes and really get better before I do that.
It's
I don't
on
want to be
top.
I don't want to be the last old guy. I'm second to last, I'll be all right.
Sounds like you've got a bit of competitive spirit
Oh
going
yeah,
on there.
no, I'm in business. I played sports at a high level, and so I always want to be better.
Yeah, that is a natural. We all want to sort of improve. I just wondered if you had that little bit of racer in you. It sounds like you have.
And that's why, I do the same thing in my business world. I take extra classes. Nobody says you have to go to these extra classes, but I think it makes you better at your life. The world has changed, but you can't go. I can't use the same thing I learned in 1984 and 88 and 89 to then run a business and dealing with 2024 people.
Yes, no, I agree. You can't have too much knowledge, and you can choose to use it or not.
Right.
You do if it's useful and choose to use it.
Yes. And
Have you ever thought about electric motorcycles? Because laws are changing on that front.
yes, I like them. I test drove a live wire. I think out of every motorcycle I've ever had, that one scared me the most, as I was test riding it. Just like with the Tesla car, there's no sound. And the power is instant, so it's very quick off the start. So it was kind of orientating when you're on the bike, because there's no rumble of where you're at in gear or speed. So yeah, it was probably the scariest. I do have an electric scooter, which scares me probably more than some of my race bikes, because it will throw you off of it if you go straight throttle on it, because it's an electric scooter.
Yeah, there are some differences that it's the same animal, but with some different feelings.
Yeah.
And yeah, when you do throttle off, you still keep rolling.
With the motorcycles, with the electric motorcycles, and I use this assumption with the Tesla, when you go on to the gas, it's like you're on 100%. You're on, so the power to it is instant. And that's the same feeling you got with the motorcycle, an electric motorcycle. The power is instant. The torque is instant, versus our minds and our bodies have grown up in this world of turbocharged cars and high powered motorcycles, that when you start on the throttle, you get the sound first and you get the delay, and your body can prepare for the inertia and the not the inertia but the torque.
Yes, you're feeding from all of that input. Sound
Yeah.
is a
And
big
your
part.
history tells you, hey, this is where we're now going to start some motion.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been speaking to quite a few people about it because it is the way to come. It's the way things are going.
Well, yeah, I think the battery packs will have to get larger. I mean, around town there might be good, and the speeds to charge would have to get better on charging motorcycle batteries and car batteries.
But that with there will be progress, and those sort of things will, I think, be ironed out.
Yeah, I think in Europe, where cities are massive and people don't drive 90 miles to go to the office, they're huge and it could be very successful, but I would be out of juice on my round trip, so I'd have to find charge here at the office or back at the house
Yeah, there are all
all
sorts
the
of
time if I had a live wire.
all those areas. They will get sorted because manufacturers will have to find a way. I think it's interesting. It's great to be on the verge of this sort of new technology, new laws. I mean, there was a time, like you say, when people had to wind their cars up to start them at the front, and somebody
Right.
had to walk in front with a flag. But
I tell all my friends because I'm not bad. I'm not against Teslas. I've had them and electric cars, and I have a Taycan now. But we've had over 130 or 140 years of building gas stations on every corner, and it's probably going to take a good while before we have a charging station sufficient enough for 350 million Americans or whatever it is to discharge, and get charging up to a place where you can take a car from here to Florida without stopping three or four times and spending an additional 3 or 4 hours charging.
Yeah, it's getting there though. I find it very interesting. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it's it's going to be something to look forward to. Or, and I'm sad that they're taking their On the other hand, I'm sad that they're taking away one of the best engines ever made, a V12. I love the sound of a V12, and there's nothing like it, or a aspirated V10 or V8. They're, taking those away. But having a hybrid solution with a V8 with a hybrid battery producing 1,000 pounds is also a lot of fun to ride in or ride, drive.
Yeah. I mean, the people, our generation will be sad because, we've been living the experience of the internal combustion engine, but the newer generation who haven't had that's just sort of easing out for them. They'll be all excited about their thing, their
Yeah.
era.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they might get to, sort of 60 years old and look at another new thing that's coming in,
Yeah,
it's
probably.
going to be
Yes.
like the electric, they'll never get
Yeah,
charging stations.
mine will be probably all grayed out and in some museum somewhere or rotting in some farm.
Yeah.
There'll be all new pickers and what's that show on AME where the
Oh,
guys
yes.
find barn finds. Maybe my
Farm
car will be a barn find
finds.
or my
Well,
bikes.
it's been lovely chatting with you,
Thanks,
I have to say.
nice meeting you, Audi.
I'm going to look more into, I think, what new learners are being taught, and maybe do a few more podcasts on that, and see what sort of feedback we get, because it's a very interesting point.
Yeah, it's something that is interesting, and anything that can make people safer and have better riding experiences, I think will help. Because I don't know how many 60-year-olds are going out and buying bikes, but if they learn when they're younger, there are a lot more guys that are older than me and guys who started when they were young and want to be safer, and their kids are grown, their grandkids are up at an age, or their kids are married, and they're like, hey, I'm gonna go start riding again, and they're coming to champ school and they're riding. Met a guy who was 78 years old riding.
That's great. I mean, for me, it's sharing the joy. I want other people to come into motorcycling and to get that intense emotional feeling that goes with the whole of motorcycling that I cannot describe in one word. So that's what it is for me. That's why I want more people riding.
Sometimes I think I go, wow, I wish I would have learned when I was younger. But then I go, well, maybe I wouldn't have the enthusiasm and the love of it as I do now. Maybe I would have had a bad experience, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, and never got back on a motorcycle.
Yeah, you never know, but
Things work out. But
you're finding the joy now, so let's just
yes, I'm
make
enjoying the heck out of it. All right, I better let you go. We only got a couple hours of good weather here, and I'm going to be riding in.
want to get out on
I want
the
to get out.
road. Oh, thanks,
Call me
Ray.
later if you have any questions.
Ta-da, then.
Right, bye-bye. Bye.